Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. I'm Phil Carroll.
And I'm Kevin Hornsby.
It's Sunday the 15th of October, well into autumn. Weather has turned after a glorious start to October. Been in Rome this week, home of the carbonara and other fine foods. How's your week been, Kev?
Yeah, it's been good. I've been a bit under the weather, but I was on the north coast, Mediterranean.
You think that's something you may have picked up on the flight back home from the US?
Possibly, but I don't think so, because that was over a week ago. But Naveen was already sick just before we left the US, so yeah, it's been going around us all. But I was on the north coast, so I was sort of 800 kilometers from what's been happening in Israel and Gaza. So yeah, it's been interesting to say the least, isn't it? It's like, well, interesting is the wrong word. It's been absolutely appalling.
Devastating, isn't it? Yeah.
Abhorrent what Hamas have done. I did have sympathy for the Palestinian people, but I've lost all sympathy, I have to say, in terms of the way that they behaved. Incredible. Incredible.
I think it's fair to say that Hamas is not the face of your average Palestinian. You know, I mean, obviously that they are the, well, they call them a militant group, but I think that you could actually describe them as a terrorist organization, which a lot of the Western media have almost been, I wouldn't say afraid to call them, but I don't know what, there's been a reluctance to acknowledge it, which is, I find a bit bizarre, because they, from what I'm seeing in the media, that some of the things that they've done, as you described them as abhorrent, have effectively been associated to someone like, you know, what someone like ISIS would have done to, you know, in Iraq and in Kurdistan and places like that. But yeah, obviously dominated this week the news with the Hamas terrorist attack on Israel. Whilst we record this on Friday, it looks like Israel are readying for a ground invasion after they warn 1.1 million people to flee North Gaza within 24 hours. Gaza residents have been told to relocate to the south of the Strip in the next 24 hours, according to the United Nations. Israel's military has directly told Gaza City residents to leave for their safety and protection as its forces mass ahead of an expected ground offensive. I mean, how do you think, is it even possible to move more than 1 million people in a day?
No. Israel are now just playing partly a political game, but it's quite obvious there's a lot of anger and a lot of retaliation that wants to take place. In a way, I wish to take a bit of a deep breath, but the problem is Hamas have put them in this position now because of the hostages. It's almost like if there wasn't the hostages involved and they'd gone in and done what they did and then gone back, it's like then it's not the same situation. So I don't know. I think basically Gaza is going to be a place you will not be able to habitate in the next 5-10 years. To be honest, I think they're going to level it.
I think not even 5-10 years. I think within the next 2 or 3 weeks. I mean, it already looks like they've started devastating a large part of it in the financial areas. Obviously, some hospitals have been. And it's always the innocents, isn't it, who get involved and the ones who are the
victims. Yeah.
It's just like the Israelis who were partying at the festival, who were gunned down, and the people living in the kibbutz very close to that. I mean, it's devastating, and I didn't think we'd ever see something quite like this again in so close to where you are, and obviously so close to Europe.
Yeah. Well, no, it's the stated aim of Hamas in Gaza. It was the stated aim of the IPLO, who used to be, and then it's now the PLO or whatever it is, because they've said that they will not take up arms. It's the stated aim of Hezbollah in Lebanon, in sort of the first part of Beirut, which they control completely, for the total destruction of the state of Israel and the killing of all Jews. This is their stated goal. So we have to understand, we and anyone in the West doesn't think like this. Okay, we don't think like this, but they think like this, and it is their stated goal. So though we can say, you know, please protect the civilians and please do this, you're not dealing with someone who thinks or even operates the same way that you might think or operate. You are just not dealing with that situation. And I suppose the Jewish state, I mean, people have said the Jewish state has a lot to answer for. And in a way, the way they've treated the Palestinians, they do. But this has now come to the point where they've shown themselves as pure evil in terms of what they've done. And I see that Israel is basically stating, especially Netanyahu, that every Hamas soldier will be wiped off the face of the earth. That's basically what he said. And I think that's what he's going to pertain to do. Now, the problem is, how are all the other Arab states and all their supporters around the world going to react to them going in and doing that? This is the problem. And you've got the US, the UK saying, okay, Israel, you can basically do what you want right now because you've got our support.
But I think this could potentially destabilize the whole of the Middle East if we're not careful. You know, it's almost like an Arab Spring type event. You know, you had Syria, you had Tunisia, you had Morocco. You know, it's like a catalyst, isn't it, that just will ripple through.
It is. And I mean, they're trying to negotiate the Rafah crossing, which comes into Sinai, which is Egypt, which is also contentious because the Israelis tried to take this in the 1960s. And then the 6th of October rising happened, which is the big thing they celebrate in Egypt, to take it back. And that's when the Camp David agreement happened in the 70s with Carter, you know, the peanut farmer. And effectively, that peace between Israel and Egypt has been there ever since, 50 years, you know. So I think it was since 1973 when the Camp David agreement happened, I think. Don't quote me on that. But a long time, anyway. So Egypt is almost like, well, you want us to open that border and effectively let 2 million Gaza people into Egypt? Well, where are they going to go?
Yeah,
because they can't stay in Egypt, because that's not going to work. And the problem is that the people of Gaza, whether you like it or not, a huge proportion of them are totally against Israel because of the way they've been treated over a period of time. And a good proportion of those are terrorists and willing to do things.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Very difficult situation.
It's political and it's also religious, obviously, because of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. And this is a very holy place for Islam, as well as being a very holy place for the Jews in terms of, you know, Jerusalem. So it's a mess. Let's put it that way.
All right. We'll move on to our first guest this week. We're joined by Colin Bird, Executive Chairman of Extract Resources. Welcome, Colin. How's things?
Things are good. Thank you very much. Yeah. Moving towards the end of summer now, I guess, and attention will be back to our, hopefully anyway, to our market and to the markets. And I'm hoping that as we come into the latter part of the year, that we'll see a bit of a revival of our sector and new fundamentals for next year.
Yeah,
my wish. But of course, as I've said many times on your podcast, heads down doing what we do. Can't really control some of the factors which affect markets.
We saw some positive news this morning that the ONS released its statistics bolstered by August economic growth, which I think was led by the service sector with a 0.2% GDP increase. So, you know, we're not in the recession yet if we're seeing these, you know, month-on-month increases in GDP.
I've got a little theory, not totally mine, a bit of plagiarism, but in the days when countries with big manufacturing concerns, slowdowns went into recessions much quicker and easier because people weren't buying the big things that you manufactured, all the manufactured items. When, you know, the economies we're talking about are largely service economies, the reaction is not necessarily as extreme as they might have been in the past. The past being 10, 20 years ago, they will probably be shorter and less debt. So I think the talk of recession essentially is we are talking against a different environment. That's a little bit philosophical, but I think that's the way I see things.
Yeah. And how do you think, what do you think, obviously we're currently in effectively what feels like the second war, effectively, you know, potentially a land invasion over coming days with Israel potentially moving into Gaza. How do you feel that's going to affect the markets? Obviously, some of it may have been priced in over the last few sessions, but it certainly looks like things are beginning to destabilize in the Middle East, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think we're all a bit shocked, aren't we? And I think that's why the reaction might yet to be seen. We all have to hope, I think, that Israel shows some restraint. The moral ground is certainly theirs. Let's hope they show some restraint, but there's a limit to how much you can be provoked, I guess. The war in Ukraine, you know, has taken background as the whole world turns around and looks at this. And, you know, there's so much polarization in the Middle East that the potential, I think, to upset everything, as it were, is greater than Ukraine-Russia. And it's sad, isn't it, that Saudi and Israel were ready to start talking and trade get-togethers. And you know what? I think that's what might have inspired Hamas to try and upset, because the last thing they want is peace in the Middle East. So I haven't given up yet. I'm probably not as pessimistic as some might be. Israel, I think, will show the restraint that is necessary, but it will be protracted, and it will have a lot of international focus by the humanitarian groups, because, you know, if you don't use guns and you don't invade, and yet you try to sort of cut off all the amenities, electricity, water, etc., you know, that's got a devastating effect on the immigrants, and that will have massive human relation focus on Israel and hopefully on the problem. So I think it will all go on, and it's very sad when you start talking about markets and fortunes and related to those terrible, terrible circumstances, but I guess the reality says one has to. So it hasn't helped. As I say, I don't think it's a ticking time bomb. I think it's just something now which will be basically attrition, and I think it will be a long, drawn-out process with lots of saber-rattling and lots of rhetoric, but I think with restraint by Israel.
Yeah, for sure. So should we move on to Extract then? Obviously, being a producer, exploration and development company with projects in Australia, Mozambique and Zambia, recently released unaudited interim results for the 6 months ending 30th of June 2023. Do you want to just take us and the listeners through some of those operational and financial highlights, please?
Well, together, I mean, the operations, quite frankly, we all know about Bushranger. Bushranger drilled a huge amount of holes over the last couple of years. We've assembled a resource, and we know, the market knows, that the resource is not really explored, quite frankly. We've ended up with 1.3 million tons of contained copper, and one could go and explore, and I'm sure you could double, possibly triple that amount. But the total quantum of copper, not the acid test, is when you work this copper on a yearly basis. Can you have a surplus of income over expenditure? How much capex do you need? How big a mine have you got? Will you have the confidence to build against the resource? Will you have the confidence to build against the copper price? You know, I mean, obviously, the more you mine, the divisor gets better, the unit cost gets better. And these things can drop to something like $15, $16 a ton milled and mined. So if one's looking for the copper prices we're looking for, there's no doubt in my mind that Bushranger will be a project. And it's absolutely no doubt in my mind that Bushranger will be a project one day. But this copper price is confounding, isn't it? You know, there's so much going on. And I think there's a determined effort to try and restrain the copper price. Popped his nose over 8,000 again. But the pundits a year ago would have been talking about $10,000 a ton now. That's got to happen, Phil. And it's going to happen. We know it's going to happen. And you don't need to go on and on about electric cars and all of that. In actual fact, you need to talk about emerging economies and their need for basics. And that gives you a copper demand is well above current production. And the electric car story, and that electrification in general just doesn't help the story in terms of the demand side. And the supply side is pretty dreadful. And Codelco the other day, I don't know if you saw, there was a big mode going on in Chile and a request for more money to go into Codelco. So it's hurting the big producers. And he said not many of them are inspired to build new mines, because they're waiting for the copper price. The trouble is, when you build one of these new mines in Chile, you're waiting 15 years. So will our project get there? Well, hopefully we're completed the analysis and all of the fundamentals and the critical parts which will make it a project and not a project. So that shouldn't take too long before we'll be putting that into the public domain. So it's do we drill more? How does it look? What shape is it? What price does it need to work? All in the mix at the moment. So a good project in a good location, 1.3 million tons of copper, drilled out and still determining its sort of raw fundamentals. We move over to Mozambique. That gold mine's producing, approaching maturation. Month on month, it improves in terms of its production. And our operating, collaborating partners are moving towards what I call maturation. Where that is it 85 kilos? Is it 100 kilos? To be seen, but there's no doubt in my mind that the oxides work very well with recoveries of about 89%, which is really, really very good. And that we do know from past work that the sulfides will produce a mine which will endure for another 10 to 15 years with either an extension to the existing plant or alternatively a new plant dedicated to sulfides. But of course, the mission is to find oxides on the concession as well, more oxides to keep the pressure ongoing before you invest in further processing capacity for sulfides. So that's all going on, but an operation which is We've got a 23 partnership. It's into production. It's constantly increasing production month on month and approaching maturation with the potential of a long life in front of it. That's that. And then, of course, we're very pleased. Why wouldn't we be with our latest acquisition in Zambia, the Northwest? We're pretty sure that's on the Western Foreland. We're pretty sure that Congolese type mineralization will be evident there. We're getting as, believe it or not, the way we're approaching it is just a blank piece of paper, almost like an artist would. And we're putting every bit of information, geological that we know, lineaments, faults, copper shown on surface, neighboring mines, structuring, key structures for the area, mine structures. And we're going to try to intelligently approach a program to confirm our belief that we are in the Congo-style mineralization. And then, of course, that gives us, it may give us two shots. One shot being near surface, copper and cobalt, and deeper, the Kamoa-style mineralization. It's a very, very nice. Phil, you won't believe it. You will not believe up in Kamoa there. It's about 60 kilometers away. It's flat and 3 meters thick with 6% copper. So this Ivano there, I mean, you know, it's a miner's dream. You've not got to try and second guess which way this dips, which way that folds. You're literally coal mining in a metalliferous situation with 6% copper. I mean, no wonder it's the second richest mine in the world and growing by the day. So we think we've got that style of mineralization. And before we employ the machine, if you like, the truth machine, the drilling machine, we are doing desk research. Next thing is to go on the ground and prove some of our theories, or test some of our theories with a view to proving our theories, and pursue this target. I think that I don't really want to joint venture it unless we have to, Phil, because, you know, the money is made for your shareholders buying in there and proving something up yourself, not by giving a big chunk of it away for others to prove it up. So our intent will be to hang in there to add as much value as we possibly can. We know we're in the right area, and I know I've got a way of sometimes being very optimistic, but I'm going to be optimistic. In terms of the world, I think that Northwest Zambia is the best exploration target to fit short-term production. It's not a porphyry that's going to take 15 years. It's going to take 4 or 5 if you find a decent-sized chunk of metal, which is flat like the Kamoa, but nonetheless, much much quicker to bring into production and much more successful, not dealing with very, very low grades. So return on investment is better. Time to capitalize is better. The footprint of the equipment is smaller. All in all, a much better proposition. And so I feel blessed for our shareholders that we've managed to procure this position. I really do. And look forward to bringing under the results that I'm sort of, what's the best word, I'm gushing about now, because I really feel very, very good about that position.
We've got Extract. We've got a £10 million company in market cap or thereabouts. And you've got producing gold mine, or you've got 23% of a producing gold mine producing, as you said, hopefully anywhere from, I don't know, 80 kilograms upwards, hopefully per month coming in. And your percentage of the profit in that, you've then got on the back boiler now, Bush Ranger in the Australian situation. So the real forward-looking situation for Extract seems to be Zambia, clearly. So tell us what your thinking is behind this and how you're going to move that forward. So, you know, give people an overview of what you think is going to happen.
Well, my stomping ground has always been Southern Africa. Zambia has been extremely kind to me. You know, we discovered the Kalambila in a different life. I discovered the Kalambila mine, which is now the central mine, the 14th biggest mine in the world, copper mine in the world. So Zambia has been, on an individual basis, been very kind to me. We made this venture into Australia. We couldn't resist it because, let's face it, there was so much copper in the Lachlan Fold, and we certainly proved that to be the case. But back to Zambia, the president is committed and he's talking about the country producing 3 million tons of annual copper. The majors are returning. The big boys are there now, the Rios, the Cobalt, the new Bill Gates, Bezos are investors in the project. They're there.
Vedanta have gone back in, apparently.
Vedanta have back in, government involved. Well, I don't know what the mechanism was for them to return back in. And that DD sort of nationalizes, if you like, KCM. So KCM will be coming back into production. Mopani is not very far behind. So that accounts for Kitwe, and that accounts for Mufulira. So, you know, if you sit back a little bit, it's a very, very exciting place to be, Zambia. And Mark Bristow, you know, Barrick, they announced a $2 billion investment in Lumwana. And if you wanted a dog of the copper industry 10 years ago, 8 years ago, it was Lumwana. So it's, you know, it's quite interesting how things change. So they're investing $2 billion there. So Zambia is one of the best places to be, if not the best place, in my opinion. And I said the other day to someone very, very senior in Zambia, was raised their eyebrows and said, no, Zambia has not been explored yet. And he looked at me and said, with so much copper production, you know, how can you say that? I said, well, you know, those mines which were started in the 1920s, 100 years later, are still going. There's not been a lot of incentive by the majors to explore concepts outside the traditional copper belt concept. Everywhere we go as a little junior, and when we do test, you know, we do stretch the elastic. In the central, we're finding copper gold situations, IOCGs. In the northwest, we're the one, you know, academia has talked forever about IOCGs, and academia have talked about huge mineralization styles similar to the Congo in the northern end of Zambia. We tested it, you know, with First Quantum's money. We hadn't got that big a budget to go down and do the initial trial work. So when you think about it, and I make the statement that Zambia is not yet explored, I justify it by the statements I've just made. IOCG occurrences not followed up. And Northwest, I think, going to come up with tremendous results of large bodies, copper, some on surface for new surface mines. Others a bit deeper for new underground mines of a different style to the old days.
Yeah.
So very, very exciting times for Zambia and a good place to be with a very strong management and ministry who are very much supporting the work of we juniors and, of course, majors as well.
So I believe that they need a copper revival to help pay back billions of dollars in debt, wasn't it, from bonds that I think they defaulted or certainly around, was it 2020? And I think they're saying now that the government is saying that this year's production is predicted to fall below 680,000 tonnes, which is the lowest in 10 years. So there really is a kind of a drive to get that, you know, the mining back into Zambia.
Yeah, that's right. And they do know they can't do it alone. You know, Glencore left and were left with the Mabani mines. It was a spat, if you like. It should have called it spat with Vedanta, not went Vedanta. Well, Vedanta's back. Rothschild's the manager bidding process. So you have the two biggest mines in the country should be back building up to full production over a space of 2 or 3 years. And as I say, exploration activities recommenced. Lumwana is back in the fold as probably a large mine. Kansanshi has got a big, I think it's $1.3 billion agreed investment by the board of First Quantum. So that's also great. So, you know, what is now that lowest production? I think if you turn the clock forward 2 years,
yeah,
it might well be its biggest ever year of production.
Yeah, would it be safe to say that most of the production comes from outside of the copper belt now, in that northern sort of northwestern region that you alluded to, or the hopes of?
Yeah, well, when you say outside the copper belt, some of those mines are traditional copper belt style mineralization. There's no doubt about it at all. Solwezi on the north there is really the center, if you like, of all current activities. Yeah. And then as you go down towards the old Luansha, then things are dying out. And, you know, it's sort of residual small properties. And then central Kitwe and Mopalera, of course, are maybe facing a huge revival. And we shouldn't forget those massive dumps, what they call the OBs. They were oxide, you know, in the old days, the oxides were considered nothing but a nuisance and they were waste. And there's huge dumps in the Chingona region of copper-rich oxides available for the experts to treat.
Available for Jubilee to come in and do them all.
Well, that's one company which could be considered, of course, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell us about Kikuyu then. Kikuyu is obviously one of the things within Extract, one of the deals. So tell us what's happening. Where are we?
Yeah, that needs an exploration program. That in one way, fortunately, turned in our favor that we went to clean up a small mine locally and a bit of money on the way when in actual fact, The more we cleaned up, the more we opened up surface expressions. Then our field work picked up, shall we say, parallel bodies, not necessarily at the same time. We picked up cobalt. And so that one is subject to re-evaluation, if you like. And I think it's probably more of an exploration situation than it is production, because it's quite a few unknowns and it's much bigger than we thought. How big? We don't know. We have to go in there and put the drill machine in. And of course, it would be quite cavalierish to go in and start pushing back those faces with a view to go into the whole body that we've discovered. Of course, we'd be literally guessing. So work required there to actually find out what we've got, the size of what we've got, and decide whether or not it's a small mine that can be extended with limited life, or alternatively, could it grow into something quite a bit bigger?
So the button is on pause for actually just going and doing the small mine bit. Until you know more.
That would be capillaries to go in and start, you know, just stripping when you don't know what you're stripping, where you're going, what the stripping ratios are. And then, of course, there's a capacity issue as well in terms of processing. There's some processing capacity being developed in the area, and it would be easier to co-share with them than to produce something that you've got to, you know, ship a long way in order to beneficiate. So that comes into the matrix as well. That comes into the equation.
So the project that you're going to have to put money into in the north of Zambia, again, tell us what's the situation. Why did a small junior go into something that it has to fund itself?
If you're going to value add, you don't want to share with others. So that's an election we've made. When you've got something which is extra special, you want to share it with others, not necessarily. When you get to a point when it's beyond your resources, particularly financial, then you have to share. We're not at that point yet. And even though we've got a dismal market, not a very happy market at all, we have a market that understands what discovery means. And especially, you know, I've got an history of discovering it as well. If you're not very far from those projects, some 60, 70 kilometers, and turning a small company into a $265 million sale, there's going to be lots of those in the next 4 or 5 years. They're not going to be confined to Zambia. Anybody who finds anything, be it Latin America, be it Eastern Europe, be it Australia, if they find, and I think the bar will lower from 2 million contained tons of copper to half a million tons of copper. And the bar will lower, and I think the majors will go be buying these projects. So why not add the value as best and as far as you can, sooner than early on roll over and give away a lot of share that you can live to wish you hadn't later on in the game. And that's the Kalambila story, of course. You know, we spent 5 million and sold it for 265. If on the other hand, you do a joint venture too soon, you may give 70 or 80% of the equity away. They spend 5 million and they get a mine which can go on for the next 25, 30 years. So you've not done your shareholders the best favor by joint venturing too early. It's like selling an house that you've ever been inside, and you don't know how big the garden is, but you take the first offer what comes along. We know we're in fertile pasture, and we certainly want to find out how fertile, what's its relative position before, or if ever, we go around looking for collaboration joint venture partners. And of course, never say never, because you don't know what's around the corner. You don't know what type of offers you get. So I counter the old statement with that. You don't know what's around the corner. So, but as we are now, we're committed to getting value out of it before we actually allow anyone else to come in and dilute us significantly.
And you talked about the market being in a bad place. What is the, often the market's very penal in terms of the situation of companies when they need cash. So what's the situation with Extra?
Well, we've got our cash flows coming from that existing mine. I don't think we've been to the market now for, maybe, is it 3 years, Kevin? I know the boards, bulletin boards, were forecasting the year before last in February. We'd be there with the tin, and we didn't come. There was a very strong suggestion that last February, June, we'd be out looking for a secondary financing. It didn't happen. And so I think all I can say, in all honesty, is that if we have to finance, we will go out to the market. If we can let our cash flow and benefits from the gold operation keep us alive, as regards our, not alive, because that's not my use, survival is not my use, but keep our exploration projects in the Northwest advancing and progressing materially, then if we don't need to go to the market, we don't need to go to market. So I think what I'm saying it badly, is that the situation will determine less than the market. You know, that if we find that reef that we're looking for near surface, and we want to mount an intense large scale drilling program, it creates a different environment for the treasury, and then we'd have to address it at that time. So I think let's all stay open minded. We've got a duty to directors to keep the company funded. I've got a personal belief that, dilution I don't like, nobody likes, and it's a dirty word which none of us want to talk about. And we all know the cost of money, don't we, Kevin? We all know the cost of money.
Yeah, it's an impossible question to answer because you can't say, no, we'll never have to race because you just don't know what fantastic opportunity comes along that.
I don't think a public company can say, you know, because let's face it, it's currently six shares. So, you know, the circumstances dictate always.
Yeah, but the reality is at the minute, you don't need to raise money. That's basically what you're saying. So, I mean, what would you like to say to the shareholders who bought into this, if you like, Bushranger Australian dream? What can we say to, I don't even know what the right word is, but to not to finish it, because it's not finished, but it's on the long finger now in terms of how much further it's going to go. What would you like to say?
Well, yeah, the Extract management, together with its shareholders, made this acquisition in Australia. Certain forecasts were made, very, very positive about the geology of the area. We mounted an intense drilling program, which was more for a major company than a junior company, and one borehole failed. I think every single borehole hit mineralization, and we built up a resource from about 175,000 tons to 1.3 million tons contained copper equivalent. So when you think about it, technically, the board and its shareholders achieved a massive step forward. And it ain't done yet, as you say. There's a mineralization to the northeast, there's mineralization to the northwest, there's mineralization to the west. We haven't drilled the Ascot ore body. And so your guess is as good as mine of how big this is. What we're at, but you know, you can't keep drilling forever and like a pincushion. Sooner or later, you've got to go to the drawing board and you've got to define a mine. And that's what we're busily doing now and seeing what sort of copper price you need to, you know, to justify the level of capital. First of all, you define the level of capital, then you define the operating cost, then you've got all the infrastructure. And then, of course, the wild card is this ore sorting, what time you bring it in, et cetera, et cetera. And we probably think that now, the first 7 or 8 years can be on the high grade and you don't ore sort until thereafter. So that's probably more. Possibly could be a conclusion. So we're in the middle of it all. But if you turn the clock back, what we wanted to do, we wanted to find a stack of copper. We've achieved that. We've made one of the biggest moves forward in Australia in terms of the Lachlan Fold. Nobody's discovered as much in the Lachlan Fold as we have. Of a 35,000 meter program, only one hole was unsuccessful. And so a lot was achieved and it leaves a lot to be achieved. But I think we need a copper market in excess of what we've got now. But the absolute confidence to press, you know, for someone to press the button and start developing.
Yeah, which hopefully will come.
You know, that's copper price dependent, but, you know, there's not many places in the world, in the sort of free world, in the free commercial world, where you've got a block of copper as big as that, near surface, fairly easy to understand, metallurgically easy to process in flat lying land. I mean, it's a little jewel in its own right, but it's, you know, it's all back to a kind of homogeneous grade, which is a little low and needs upgrading. And then that brings all the costs, you know, what size of mine you have, how much upgrade, effectiveness of the upgrade, what stage you upgrade. And then conversely, you know, that you can actually stand in the corner and say, do we really want that great big mine? Is there still an opportunity for a smaller proposition? Because, you know, the higher grade material may support a mine. We're not sure about that yet, and we're looking into that. So at the moment, a very open approach to a very open book.
So while all that is going on, which way are you taking Extract Resources?
What do you do when you're walking through a lemon plantation and you're not there for commercial picking, you're there to make sure when you leave, your basket is full. And that obviously is the two projects in the northwest of Zambia. That is the low-hanging fruit. It's got a new geological model that one of us find, and I have an intersection. I don't think you need to find an ore body. I have an intersection which proves it's Kamoa, i.e. 3 meters, 6% is game on. I think we're in the right place of all the companies. We're in the right place. We've got two very large expanses of ground. And if you want low-hanging fruit, immediate return for investors, positioned at the right place when that inevitable increase in copper price comes, then without doubt, we are moving towards Zambia and we're moving towards Northwest Zambia and our exploration projects there. And all our desk work and preparatory work is aimed in that direction.
Okay. I think, you know, looking at Extract as a package, I mean, I suppose it's hard to value, but if you were looking at the gold in Mozambique, 23% of a share of something that's producing 85 kilograms of gold,
I mean, what is that whole project worth, do you think?
Well, I don't know. Let's do some theoretical numbers, because, you know, we should avoid forward-looking statements. But if you assume, let's just assume that the annual cash flow would be 6 million to extract, and the annual cash flow received would be 6 million, then that would be 36 million. And then on a DCF rough calculation, that would be 60 million. Discount that at 10% because the mine's up and running. So it probably it's about 54 million. So there's a 55 million NPV for our share. So against the market cap, that looks a bit sick, and it's sustainable for you know, 10, 15 years. The simple multiple is 6, isn't it, when you've got gold and copper. So then if you were looking at 6 times earning free cash flow, that'd be 36 million, which is what about
27 million pounds. So
that order.
Okay, so this fundamentally is what's underpinning should underpin the value of Extract Resources. On top of that, we've got the Zambia asset, and on top of that, it's impossible to put a valuation on a sum of the parts valuation on Australia, but it's not worth showing.
Far from it. We can monetize it in many, many ways. And then, of course, as you say, we've got the bluest of blue skies up in northwest Zambia, together with a kind of earnings base. So that makes us a lot different to have the blue sky and the earnings base and a project which is capable of being monetized. So all in all, 10 million is a massive disconnect. But I mean, show me a CEO in London who isn't saying that.
Yeah, no, it's across the board, but it's good to understand what the actual disconnect is. And I suppose as the weeks and months go by, and then over the next few months, it will become more apparent, I think, the Mozambique money than it is at the minute. Even though it is apparent, you know it's happening, but the market obviously is going to be reporting that stuff on a more frequent basis, I think.
Yeah. And, our internal management decision is even though it makes your belly roll sometimes, you really have got to keep adding value to your projects, so that when the starting gates really open, it's going to be the copper price. We're all going to be a call options to copper price. You know, when the gates open, we're up and ready, and we're in front of most of the horses who are just thinking about going out the gate and starting running, we'll be half a furlong up the track. Our projects are all ready. A lot of them being drilled. You know, by Joe, some really good projects. And so it's been our intent not to sit and cry in our beer, but to, in actual fact, add value. Because instinctively, we all know that it has to change. But of course, you can't live in the wish land forever, and one has to be very careful of your treasury as far as you can in this day and age. But nonetheless, keep active. And I think a lot of companies haven't kept active, they've been just mindful of the treasury. Let's hope when it does change, as I say, we're out of the starting gates and up and running, and hopefully somewhat leader of the pipe.
Yeah, let's hope so. And we look forward to, at some point in the next few months, we will come and visit some of these things in Zambia, so people can have a on-site view of what it is we're talking about, and where the drill bit will tell its tale, as you say.
Yeah, that speaks for itself. When all the conjecture is finished and all the protestations and forecasts are finished, the drill machine will tell you the story. But we're confident, very, very confident. And remember, it's not blind confidence, because we've had a massive success in that area before, only 60 kilometres away. We understand the geology.
Good. Colin Bird, Executive Chairman of Extract Resources, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for your time. Thank you very much, James.
Thanks, Colin.
And we welcome our second guest this week. We're joined by Sean Day, MD of Greatland Gold. Welcome back, Sean. How's things?
Yeah, really well. Thanks for having me on again. Good to catch up.
Yeah, indeed. So, I mean, obviously, it's been a while since we last talked. I was just scanning through some previous RNS announcements and going back to sort of about a month ago, I believe you were in the Denver Gold Forum in Colorado. Do you want to tell us how things went there and what you sort of what you took home from that?
Yeah, look, we went through Denver and then actually came through London and did a town hall meeting and caught up with some institutions there. But I think for both our trip through Denver and also for the London Roadshow, look, we continue to get more meetings, more institutional engagement, see more institutions appearing on our register. And this trip also had that manifest again. So, yeah, we feel we're getting traction as the story continues to mature. You know, what we're seeking to do is maintain and broaden that retail engagement, but also augment that with institutional interest. And I think certainly with the institutional interest, I think that's increasingly observable.
Sure. And how do you feel talking to, you know, shareholders? You obviously alluded to, you meet people in London, you meet retail investors, you meet institutions. How do you feel the sentiment is with retail investors, et cetera, at a time where we've got, obviously, we've had the European land war with Ukraine, and we've also obviously recently had the tensions building between Israel and Palestine. What are your thoughts? I mean, do you think people have been beaten down by, obviously, a lot of this negativity in news, obviously affecting sentiment and markets? You know, what is the take home from that?
Yeah, it's interesting. My last trip predated the incursion by Hamas into Israel, but obviously ran parallel with the Ukraine invasion by Russia. I think markets globally have been pretty soft, and perhaps in London and Europe more so than some other places. So I think the sentiment's not been as strong as it was previously. Having said that, you deal with the market you're in, and we think that creates value opportunity over time. In terms of the more recent episode with Hamas kind of doing the incursions into Israel, yeah, look, my own view is that's a pretty cynical attempt to disrupt the Abraham Accords and particularly the Saudis coming into that. I think it will be hard for Israel to show restraint, even though it might be in their best interest to show that restraint. They've obviously had provocation. And I think if the harsher their response, I think the more likely Hamas's very cynical effort to kind of break down that increased recognition of Israel is likely to succeed. And all of that creates geopolitical uncertainty in the Middle East. And you've seen an immediate reaction in the gold price, and certainly in Australian gold equities, you've seen some support for them. So this is one of the elements that we have with gold, is it can be counter-cyclical, it can be protection against risk, and certainly that Middle Eastern tensions plays into that narrative.
Okay, it's interesting to hear your thoughts on that. So, I mean, anyway, moving on to, Greatland Gold, and obviously updates since we last talked, as I alluded to, there was an update on the ongoing acquisition process of your joint venture partner, Newcrest, on Friday. Obviously, Newcrest Mining shareholders have overwhelmingly approved the $26.2 billion acquisition offer from Newmont Corporation, marking it as Australia's largest corporate deal of the year. 92.63% of Newcrest votes are in favour of the deal, surpassing the required 75% approval threshold. This follows Newmont shareholders in the US, who voted over 96% in favour of acquiring the Australian company. This transaction stands as the third largest involving an Australian company ever, and one of the top global buyouts in 2023. Initially, Newcrest had declined Newmont's offer, but after a negotiation, Newmont proposed 0.400 of its shares for each Newcrest share, and Newmont also permitted Newcrest to distribute a special dividend of up to $1.10 per share to its shareholders. The acquisition has received all necessary governmental and regulatory approvals. So what does this mean for Greatland shareholders going forward, do you think, Sean?
Well, look, I think there's been uncertainty around who our joint venture party is really since February 2023. I think it's something has probably been frustrating for people, but the reality is these kind of corporate machinations do take months and months to play out, and this has been no exception to that. So we're now really in the final throes of this transaction. It has shareholder support, both at the overwhelming support at the Newmont level and similarly very high level of support at the Newcrest level. So it increasingly looks certain to happen. It's largely procedural from here, but yeah, we'll certainly look forward to Newmont taking the keys on the 6th of November. And I think that creates, puts a level of stability back into the joint venture, because really we've had caretaker management there for much of this period as Newcrest has, really tried to chart its way either with Newcrest or without, but that's largely determined now. And I think we really celebrate that. I think Newmont is literally the largest gold miner on planet. When you have a look at one of their slides in their presentation deck, I think it's the largest 15 gold mining assets on the planet, and they hold 10 of those either joint venture or directly. So it's a massive, I think something like circa $60 billion platform. And, you know, where it's tremendous to have that organizational capability partnering with us. And I think there's some opportunities from that as well, which are potentially create option value for our shareholders. So we're really pleased with the outcome.
So how does the Australian government think about this? Because you're going to lose one of some serious amount of tax, no, in terms of what Newmont used to produce for the Australian government.
Yeah, look, I'm not sure the tax in itself will be from operations will be that different. The operations in Australia and Newmont already holds two of the three biggest, and now will be joined by Acadia. So to my mind, they'll have the three biggest Australian gold mining assets. We'll all be domiciled here in Australia for tax purposes. Having said that, having a corporate office, the people around that, the head office, the aggregation of some global profits into Australia, I think is disappointing to lose that from the Australian gold landscape. Australia is typically the largest or second largest producer of gold on the planet. You know, truth be said, it's a little bit disappointing that Australia no longer has a global gold champion in a sector where it's extremely internationally competitive. So to some extent, you know, it's not without some disappointment I see Newcrest going. If I compare it to Canada, where you've had I think it's Glencore looking at tech, you've had the Prime Minister of Canada, Trudeau, weighed into that and really a vigorous defense across the whole of the Canadian corporate space. And you didn't see any such defense by Newcrest. So that's, you know, that's a little bit disappointing. But I think for our shareholders, as I say, I think we end up with a improved capability in our joint venture partner. For us, it's a success story. And Australia, you know, together with UK and the USA, and I mentioned Canada, you know, we're all very similar culturally and from an economic perspective and huge integration. So I think those kind of things are looked at very favorably on balance by the Australian government as part of us having an open market, which over time has created, you know, an amazing economy here.
I think I've said it before on other podcasts with yourself that it's going to be they either fall in love with your project, or ultimately, probably they decide they're gonna dispose of it because it's not big enough for their portfolio. As you say, they have 10 of the world's top 15. Now, who knows what's going to happen there? And, you know, I don't think they've bought it to get rid of Newcrest's best deals. That's for sure. But how does that make you sit? And what are we going to be sort of seeing from you guys in Greatland Gold for the next sort of 6 months, say?
Yeah, look, it's hard to be deterministic about what Newmont will do. They'll want to, you know, get their feet under the desk, so to speak, and understand the asset. That said, they've spent the best part of the last 10 months understanding and doing a huge amount of diligence and research into the Newcrest asset base. But look, we kind of understand why they would fall in love with the asset. It's a beautiful ore body in a tier one jurisdiction. Yeah, there's been a huge amount of development work put into this, so we can understand why they would love it. From a tonnage point of view or a size, it probably doesn't sit in that real top 10 kind of global assets for them, which is an interesting overlay here. Even if it fitted in a $20 billion Newcrest, it's slightly less obvious whether it fits in a $60 billion Newmont. So that time will tell, but I think we certainly feel we have a good relationship with them, and, you know, the incumbent position, such as if there is an opportunity for our shareholders, I think we're well placed to achieve that, particularly with the board, the management team, and the shareholder base we have in place. And, you know, our expectation in the short term is there's a continued focus on, you know, getting that decline down to the lower aquifer and making sure we dewater and depressurize that so we can punch through to the bottom of the, or to the top of the Havieron ore body itself.
So from the point of view of Greatland Gold, you're now in a situation where you have to carry on as planned. When are we talking about being at the top of the ore body and starting to produce ore that will produce gold?
Our expectation is getting to the top of that ore body, of the Havieron ore body, in June 2024, so some 9 months away. And, you know, we've got through the upper aquifer, the middle aquifer. We still need to overcome and that lower aquifer. And then we would set up the stoking levels for mining. For good order, getting to the top of the ore body doesn't mean gold the next day. There is a a process to set up the various levels and commence production. And in the PFS, I think that was estimated to take around 3 quarters. So it's an ongoing process, but you do have a number of thresholds there, you know, top of the ore body or milestones, top of the ore body, first ore, gold doré. So there are a series of milestones as you work through that sequence.
But all of this, what's the right word, shenanigans in terms of taking over the other part of the project, I assume must in some way, shape or form have delayed the project.
Look, I think certainly it's been an interesting period for the Newcrest team to be there at a point in time where they know it's very likely, or that they had recommended that someone else take over the management of that company and its assets. And yeah, I think it's the understanding is not a lot of that old Newcrest senior team will stay in the merged group. So yeah, I think that's likely to always be a really difficult period for people as human beings, and we have empathy for that. Having said that, the mining contractor continues to make progress, albeit I think there are technical challenges as always, and we've seen differing levels of speed of progress as we've gone through aquifers over the last kind of since February 2021 when we started this process. So there's always twists and turns, but we certainly feel really confident about the team that's coming into joint venture with us, and I think that sets us up for success in the medium to long term.
So with all these Newcrest high-end people going to be thrown onto the Australian job market, do you see that will actually cause quite a gold rush in terms of new projects and different things that might happen because of that happening?
That would potentially be a tremendous outcome if it happens that, or it comes to pass that way. I think if there is this talent that comes onto the market and they undertake somewhat entrepreneurial pursuits to create value for the market, I think that would be tremendous. There's not a lot of mining activity that happens in Victoria. There is some, but it's not a huge hub of mining when once upon a time it really was a hub of Australian mining. So it will be interesting to see whether those people, migrate across the country with that skills and experience and create, or whether they kind of reskill into different sectors. I guess that will be something that each individual will assess. But I think that would be a wonderful opportunity if it does transpire that way, as you described.
I mean, it must feel a bit like history is repeating itself in a way, because I remember back in sort of 2017, 2018, Newmont were originally sort of involved and were looking at the Ernest Charles project in collaboration with Greatland. And I think they walked away from it, didn't they, back in 2018, which caused a bit of a drop in the share price. So how does it feel now? I mean, would you be devastated if Newmont effectively wanted to dispose of the Havieron interests?
Let me answer that in two parts. I think going back predates me, but I think it's a credit to Ernst Giles that we had a global major enter. From memory, I think they had a period of exclusivity. And although I think the Australian geologist team really fell in love with Ernst Giles the same way we did, it ultimately didn't get a global support. And I suspect part of that was not having in place land access and other aspects that we now have. But in terms of Newmont coming into this project, look, we're probably just focused on it being a successful joint venture with Newmont. I think we're very well placed to achieve that. Having said that, if they think in a broader sense about how they optimize their portfolio, and they have talked about in excess of $2 billion of divestments as part of creating a higher quality focus within the Newmont portfolio, I'm somewhat doubtful that Havieron does fall into that. But if it does, I think that would be an amazing opportunity. And as the existing incumbent joint venture partner and the rights we have under the joint venture, I think that would give us a huge opportunity to benefit from that. And people should certainly have confidence that we'd love that opportunity. We've built a team to do that. We've built a board to do that. And I think some of the shareholders we have there, such as our largest shareholder, Wyloo, give us a strategic capability to achieve that as well.
Sure, yeah. I mean, let's have a look at some other news. You just alluded to the loan facility as well. We agreed with the cornerstone shareholder, Wyloo, that was announced in September as well, which looks like excellent news. And obviously, new license applications at Yanari in the Gascoyne, and obviously also the Ernest Charles land access agreement. Do you want to just talk us through just quickly some of those news?
Yeah, look, why don't I do them in reverse order? We've spoken about exploration a little bit. A really excellent year from an exploration perspective. We've done the Rio Tinto exploration transaction to hugely expand our footprint across the Paterson, which we manage, and ultimately earn into 75% of it on great structure with some amazing opportunities. We finally solved the puzzle and got access to Ernest Giles. We love the geophysics there. So we've really been trying to drill that since before I arrived. And to now have the opportunity to do that is absolutely tremendous. And then we still want to encourage the exploration team, you know, and their initiatives. They've gone out and identified these Yannery holdings as something that they think upgrades our exploration platform. Yeah, we think the standouts in there presently are the Paterson and Ernest Giles. And, you know, we'd love Yannery to be of equal standing. And we want to be really active managers of that exploration portfolio. So, you know, we'll continue to look at, you know, what we can add and what we can drop up. We're not, what we can drop out. We can't own half of Australia, but we can certainly do our utmost to constantly make that platform better and better. And then in terms of Wyloo, look, you know, the importance of having such a capable and well-respected strategic holder has, you know, a huge potential number of benefits. But in this case, you know, we wanted to give market confidence that we had, you know, liquidity available to us, and particularly in a non-dilutive way. And this loan provided that to us. So look, we're really happy to put that in, and we appreciate Wyloo's support, their ongoing strategic interest and support with us, but also their capacity to do that. So yeah, I think it just talks to the relationship with them and is something we're really grateful for.
Sean, have you guys stopped playing rugby now?
You've broken up there. I can't, you're not coming through anymore, Kevin, but the...
your country stopped playing rugby now.
Yeah, and our coach is also going to head to Japan. So yeah, there's nothing good to talk about rugby. And unfortunately, normally I'd be able to reliably switch to the cricket. That's not looking much better. So it's a rare time that an Aussie cannot talk about sport.
You can talk about it, but you would have to have tears in your eyes at the same time, I think.
I think we even play England in the football tonight in a friendly. So it could be the trifecta of miserable outcomes for us this week.
I think last time we were on, you were ribbing us about the Ashes and everything, but actually we ended up with a draw, which there's no way we would have expected that after the first couple of tests.
Look, I think fortunately I was pretty measured in my comments then, but that was a cracking series. Not quite 2005 good, but it was probably the second best series I've seen.
I think rain helped you out, as in, you know, if we hadn't been for the rain, we would have potentially won that.
Yeah, I think those last three tests looked very good for England. And as you say, you only got two wins from it. But yeah, look, it's I'd probably rather talk about the cricket than the rugby, because losing to Fiji is a little difficult to accept. And we'll see how England go against them this weekend. But I suspect England will put on a pretty good effort.
We will see. But on a more serious note, geopolitical risk aside, what is the future for gold? I mean, we've got a dollar that has never been as indebted in its entire history. We've got a US economy that, whether they want to talk about it or not, is probably not going to recover as well as they think it is, unless they keep pumping more and more dollars and therefore devaluing the value of the dollar. And you've got the BRICS nations, which are trying to expand via Saudi Arabia, Egypt, etc., etc. And basically, they are going to be more than half of the world's population when they all join together. Where does gold sit with this? Because for me, I mean, from the 1970s, when we got rid of Bretton Woods, where it was effectively no longer the gold standard, maybe we're not talking about going back to the gold standard, but we have to back our fiat currencies with something. So what do you perceive is likely?
Yeah, look, I think that, you know, the opportunity for gold right now is as good as you could ever see. Yeah, I think this combination of geopolitical uncertainty, literally a land war in Europe with Russian aggression, Middle East flaring up, you've got, you know, the belligerence of China being, you know, creating a huge amount of uncertainty through Southeast Asia, with that nine dash line, and then even more so into North Asia, you know, with literally killing Indians on the border, threatening Taiwan and also kind of threatening, you know, Japanese islands. You know, it's an incredibly unstable environment. You've got that on the back of a period of quantitative easing, which, as you said, was a huge printing of core currencies, which I don't think has, you know, been done in that way historically. And then you also have a pretty dysfunctional Republican Party in the USA, which is, you know, pretty awful to watch. But I think until Trump is out of that environment, is going to continue to be pretty unstable. So it certainly is a recipe where what we see increasingly around the world is high net worth individuals and funds wanting to put some part of their portfolio into gold. And this covers strategic investors, it covers institutions, it covers the whole gamut of investors. But I think increasingly it's seen as an important hedge in a portfolio. And I think all of that creates an environment where you just saw the strongest or quickest rate series of interest rate increases in the history of economics. That should have been negative for gold, but we've actually weathered that. There may be one or two rate hikes to come. Maybe we've seen the end of that cycle, but it's certainly, you know, I think consensus is it's close to the end. And as that reverses again, that should be good for gold as real interest rates reduce. So yeah, I think the fact that gold has weathered that economic storm and then kind of emerges into this geopolitical uncertainty, you'd have to feel really good about that from from someone who has a long gold portfolio as Greatland. And then even our 25% copper is actually tremendous, because I'm still a huge believer in the electrification story, and copper is undoubtedly the best way to play that market. So we feel our balance of commodities and the diversification of commodities is advantageous.
Yeah, and what about just a comment on your share price and the fact that you've delayed the listing in Australia, which I think is understandable in these markets, but just give us your two pence on it before we close.
Yeah, look, we're still really interested in understanding the opportunity to ASX list. We did want to explore our preference is, and I think we've said this historically, is not to do it in conjunction with an equity raise. So, you know, that's the approval that we want to kind of navigate to. So it's something that we continue to assess. And if the right opportunity comes, I think we'll continue to look at taking that opportunity. But I think what we want to do by keeping the market informed was not allow market expectations or estimates of timing to interfere with. This is just a slow, methodical process to optimize timing in the market and timing for the Greatland platform.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. So, Sean, this season we're asking this question: what is the best advice you've ever been given?
I think there's a little bit to choose from there, but. And, you know, things like treat people with respect is high and value relationships and trust people. But I there's one I do in my role and I do think about regularly is life is about optionality, understanding options, preserving options, maintaining options and taking advantage of them, I think is really sound strategic advice.
Good. And what's the worst piece of advice you've ever had?
Oh, I've got to throw someone under the bus there, don't I?
Yep.
Well,
you don't have to say who gave it. You just have to say what it was.
Start with a wise old man once told me.
might be to back that Eddie Jones will be able to bring the Australian rugby team into the World Cup. That's proven to be absolutely catastrophic.
All right. Well, on that note, we'll say Sean Day, MD of Greatland Gold. Thanks very much for your time.
Hey, guys, thanks very much. That was a free-ranging conversation. I appreciate your time as well.
Thanks, Sean.
Okay, so let's have a look at some of the week's movers and shakers. The best performer 5 days is Capital Metals, actually. They're up 180% on the week. And then that came after news that the Supreme Court of Sri Lanka had upheld the expulsion of Nasir Ahmad from the Sri Lankan Muslim Congress Party. And as a result, Mr. Ahmad has lost his parliamentary seat and position as Minister of Environment, including oversight of the Geological Survey and Mines Bureau. And basically, when he was removed from office, Capital Metals expect to progress his resolving the licensing, because he was the minister who they thought was responsible for, you know, not for rescinding their license. So with him gone, they're confident now that they can get the relevant licensing and approval in place. And the share price obviously saw positivity from it and did 200% on the week. So it is good to see these things come in, but obviously it's just such a punt, not a punt, but it's such to show you how risky it is if one person in the government can affect your company in such a big way, right?
Yeah, what had the share price fallen to before it rose?
I mean, it rose back to, it was 4.2p on the Friday, around the 4.2p mark, but it dropped down to about 1.6, 1.5. It was well under the 2p mark. So yeah, it was decimated. And remember when we interviewed the CEO, it was probably over a year ago now, the stock probably around the 8 to 10p mark, wasn't it?
Yeah, if I remember rightly, yeah. So yeah, I mean, there's light at the end of the tunnel there, and hopefully that's a project that's still going to be alive and kicking and actually happens. And if it does, then yes, the shareholders will hopefully celebrate. So yeah, it's good to see some life. The other one that had some good news this week was Chilbrands. On Monday, the first, I suppose, big contract that they've got with a retailer, WH Smiths, which in the United Kingdom, which is obviously a household name, very good deal, 150 different branches, and they're all high footfall branches. So you've got the branches in the airport, like Heathrow, Gatwick, and some of the train stations as well, all over London and different places. So that's really good news, I think, and the share price did respond and then came back down a bit again. I think it hit close to 6.5p, I think it was, on Monday, and then floated back down to the top fives, I think. And then on Wednesday, I think it was, they had another RNS, Wednesday or Thursday, can't remember which.
The Amazon announcement.
Yeah, and then they announced that they were going to be listed on Amazon. So Amazon have obviously done their research. Amazon don't have any other vapes because they're not going to sell nicotine things. So the non-nicotine vape now is going to be on Amazon. So again, the share price reacted well, went up to 7p and then came back down to the mid-sixes, I think. So basically, Callum was talking about the fact this company could become, you know, cash flow positive in the not too distant future. And it looks very much like that's what's going to happen, because these are all sales. You know, they're not just stick them on the shelf and hope they're going to sell. You know, WH Smiths, it goes in, WH Smiths make an order, and then they pay for it.
Classic trade, haven't you? I mean, these are the sort of places that where you're gonna, you know, you go on holiday, or I forgot my vape, or people think they can't take a vape through security, so they think, well, I'll budget for that, and I'll make sure that when I get through airside, I've done the security checks and everything, and that, yeah, they've got a bit of time to kill, I'll go and get a book in WH Smiths or a newspaper or magazine, and while I'm there at the cash, I saw that where they have their all the tobacco and all the vaping products behind the counter, you select your vape and away you go. So you've got one for your holiday. So it makes perfect sense to get them into these, what we call the travel stores, because ultimately that's where people are going to, you know, I've forgotten it, haven't taken it because they think they can't get it through security. And it's just a great place to capture some trade, right?
Yeah, and the important thing was that this was done by a group that does distribution for many different stores, and they currently have 15,000 stores in the UK that they distribute vapes to. So I think what Callum was trying to say when we interviewed him, and also what was shown in the RNS, is that I think this is just the beginning of a relationship that will then hopefully expand and extend as the product sees more movement. The other good thing was that chill.com also took on a few more products as well this week, so it's up to, I don't know the exact number, but I think we're talking 20 brands plus now. And you know, Callum did say that he was going to have, you know, maybe close to 100 brands by Christmas. So, you know, it's well on track to do that, you know, over the next sort of 3 months. You're talking about maybe another 15, 20 every month, possibly, if he's going to achieve that. Whether he does achieve that many, I don't know. But, you know, so that's going to start building traffic to chill.com as well. So I think, you know, we've had many false dawns with Zoetic and Chill. But I don't think this is the false dawn. This is going to be sales and this is going to be revenues. I mean, the revenue created from WH Smith's is more revenue than chill.com's ever or Chill Brands ever had. So, yeah, there you go.
Okay, so the other one this week was that moved very well, not out of the blue, but certainly been dropped, you know, quite low, really, considering what the news potentially is, the upcoming news. So we had the Mast Energy Developments, Mast, MED, as they're also known, Mast Energy Developments. The binding joint venture agreement was basically announced back in May, and then there was an update at the end of September where they announced the long stop date for the first definitive and binding joint venture had been extended again. So there was an initial delay. I think there was somebody involved in that, one of the parties was unfortunately involved in some sort of road accident, which obviously delayed things, and then they moved things again, and it was expected around mid-October, so sort of pretty much any time now. And on Tuesday of this week, the stock moved up around 60 to 70%. It finished the week up 30% around the 1.4, 1.45 pence mark. So obviously a little bit of anticipation of that. And what it means is that effectively there will be an RTO of the company, and in which they'll receive quite a large sum of money for, I think it's 90% of their assets for the consortium. So effectively, I think they'll receive something like 3.5 million cash for the first phase, then another 4 million for the second, and then that with an option to take the whole lot, right? So do you want to just talk us through that, Kev?
Yeah, it was interesting, really. The market seemed to react to a Twitter post that was put on, or an X post, whatever you call it now, because basically they said, sort of, click here if you want instant information from Mast. And obviously everybody was waiting for this information anyway, and they all got on the bandwagon and thought, oh, it's coming, it's coming, it's coming. So I think potentially it is coming. Hopefully it's going to be sorted out. I'll come back to you on the valuation side of things. I mean, I think Mast is valued at around about sort of 2 million, 3 million pounds.
3 million at the current price, yeah.
Okay, so before it went up, it was closer to 2 million, I think. Its current assets that it holds on, probably a fire sale, would probably be worth 5 to 7 million pounds, okay? So let's put that in perspective, that actually it's only valued at about a third of its current net asset value without any income or anything that comes out of it. And then it's going to basically, if this happens, then it's due then to get tranches of 3 million and 4 million pounds, which, you know, it will only then own 25% of the assets that it has, but it still should solidify that it has a net asset value of between 5 and maybe 7 or 8 million pounds then, at least, which would put us at a share price of at least 4p just on the net asset values, without actually then moving forward in terms of its ability then to create an income over the next period of time, because now it will have cash to do things. So yeah, you take, or you pay your money and you take your choice. If the thing happens, then I think you're going to double treble your money. If the thing doesn't happen, then I don't think you're any worse off than buying at this price as it is now, because the net asset value is there. But the market has obviously punished it because it hasn't happened in Thai. Yeah. So yeah, there we are. Let's see. I certainly hope so. I like Peter Krugel. He's a good guy. He's a hard worker. And, you know, he's trying to make this happen for the shareholders. So let's hope that all comes off.
Yeah. So what else have we had this week? Blencar Resources received their first million from the grant, didn't they?
Yeah.
In, I think, midweek. Anything else that's been
significant? We've had Golden Metal Resources have gone on to the US OTC. So that should hopefully open up some US investors who want to invest in that US asset, you know, for tungsten.
Carillion Diamonds had positive results from the nickel, copper, platinum sampling program that they undertook recently as well, which was good to see. And then there was also news from Celadon as well, wasn't there, on Friday morning, where they initiated, I think they raised £1 million at only a 2% discount from the previous day closing share price. So that one was good to see.
Yeah, good. And we have an announcement to make about Conroy Gold. So Conroy Gold, there is going to be an investors' day in Dublin on the 10th of November. Investors are welcome. We're going to be present and obviously getting to Dublin and putting yourself up in accommodation is going to be at your own cost, but you're more than welcome. On the Friday, there's going to be full site visits, and on Friday evening, there's going to be a meal with presentations. So we ask anybody who's interested to either send us an email or to message us on any of the boards. And please come along. We've got a group, I think, already of 5 or 6 people who are going. We'd like a few more if people would like to go. So yeah, give us a shout and please come along. For anyone who's also interested in Aterian, we're also then after that visit, we're flying to Rwanda to see their lithium projects that they've done a joint venture with Rio Tinto in after that. So there'll be some reports coming back from that. We're going with Charles Bray, the chairman, to go and see that. So, yeah, they're the two things. And there will be some other things going on for Bissant and African Pioneer and Galileo, possibly Extract shareholders, but that's probably going to be into December now. So watch this space for that as well.
Good. Well, on that note, it's been long enough. Thanks for listening to this extended version, and we'll catch up with you next week.
Yep. Thank you very much indeed.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.